WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for November the 26th, 2017, the last Sunday of November. Hope you all had a good Thanksgiving holiday. Welcome to our weekly look at what's going on in politics from City Hall to Springfield all the way out to Washington, D.C. Yep, time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Okay, now, Thanksgiving is done. Now I'll start moving into Christmas mode. Although,
here we are again.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, the Showcase studio looks wonderful. The folks from Tree Time that did all the decorating. And I'm evolving into it. I'm still not there, you know, because when you get those blasts of advertising that start before Halloween, you just kind of
before Labor Day.
Well, yeah, okay. True, very true. But, you know, and then you had this weather is unbelievable. And Friday was downright balmy.
Wasn't that something?
Yeah. And all these people downtown. And although I did not see, you know, being Black Friday and everything, I did not see a lot of people carrying shopping bags.
Well, they were out maybe more looking than shopping.
Yeah, but Black Friday is supposed to be the big deal.
Big deal, right. I don't know if you heard the statistic that we reported on in the 7 o'clock news, but nationwide, overall, retailers between November 1st and Friday, Black Friday, took in $40 billion with a B.
Wow.
$40 billion.
What did you do to help the economy, Schwani?
What did I do?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I did do a little bit of shopping, but I...
Like what?
I went to a couple of stores in the Lincoln Square area.
Okay.
Now, you know what else I did at Lincoln Square?
Yes, I know exactly what I did at Lincoln Square.
I had lunch there on Friday because I'm making an effort to be at the Chicago Brauhaus every chance I get before the closing date of December 11th.
It's still hard for me to picture them closing.
They were very busy.
I bet they will be.
Right, and one phone call after another, the poor young lady behind the bar was running out of patience telling people, we're not taking reservations anymore. We're not taking reservations anymore.
I thought she was running out of patience by having to keep pouring you another stein.
Oh, me?
No. Yes.
No, she likes me.
Oh, sure. What's not to like? Andy, you do any Black Friday shopping?
You know, I did not. I did not contribute to the economy, and I really don't feel bad about it.
So you weren't part of the $40 billion then?
No. They didn't get any of my money. I just, you know, it's weird because my dad used to get into it really big time with, my dad and my mom's cousin would plan out their routes. They would plan out what stores they were going to. They even brought walkie-talkies to talk to each other in the stores to find out where each other.
Oh, I love that.
So, I mean, they used to plan it out, and, you know, I was always working, so I never really had a chance to show.
To share in.
Yeah. And
come in, floor number three.
Yeah, exactly.
Come in, floor number three.
Clean up on aisle seven.
And as much as I cover sporting events that are heavily attended, I'm not a big fan of crowds. I'm just not a real big fan of it, and I run out of patience very quickly.
Oh, I don't know what that's like.
Yeah.
That makes three of us.
Yeah, exactly.
So I figured it'd be better for me and those that are shopping to stay away. I mean, I know that the economy could have used my money, but sorry about it.
Well, now, of course, we've got Cyber Monday coming.
True.
So you'll have a chance there.
Maybe I'll make up for it there.
Although I did do a little couple of cyber things on Friday.
I probably will tomorrow.
Just to get something going, and did my best for Small Business Saturday, patronizing some small businesses yesterday, including one that's underneath the Tribune Tower and across the street. I consider that a small business.
It is.
You? Yes.
What, Mike?
It's a very successful small business.
Yes, it is.
Across the street, downstairs.
Watch the Alabama Auburn game.
The Iron Bowl, yeah.
The Iron Bowl. That was fantastic.
Yeah, and now the college football playoff has been thrown into a
shame. Yeah, with 1-2 both losing.
Which is really quite a shame. You know, I mean, I say that very sarcastically. Because I still think there's a lot of people out there that just don't understand and don't realize, you know, it obviously takes a lot to figure out computer-wise and what these guys are doing on the field, who's the number one, who's the number two team to play for the championship and all that. But it's never a bad thing when the system gets thrown out of whack a little bit to maybe tighten it up a little bit next year or the year after that.
There's always ways to tweak this.
Yeah, yeah.
Although it does seem weird with these conferences that do the championship games mm-hmm. in the conference, how you end up, you know, with the rematches.
Yeah, and you can actually hurt a team in your conference, too, especially if the two teams that are playing are in consideration for one of those four spots. And I get why the conferences are doing it. It's an extra moneymaker, and it's more admission and another set of concessions and things of that nature. But sometimes those title games actually hurt your conference's chances to get a team into the playoff.
Right. I mean, it's a game that if you're already there, you don't necessarily need or mm-hmm. want to have.
Yeah, because Wisconsin's unbeaten, and now they're going to play Ohio State for the Big Ten title.
Which, that's a championship in and of itself, almost.
Exactly, yeah.
No, it is. I did not see what happened to Miami. I just found out about that this morning. But the Iron Bowl was just, like I said, fun to watch. And then seeing the Blackhawks pretty dominant with Florida.
Yeah.
Just it's good to see. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see the replay of Jonathan Toews' goal.
I saw it live.
Did you?
Yeah, I heard John Weidemann's call of it. It's amazing. He just flicked the puck. It was bouncing, and he just stuck his stick out there, hand-eye coordination, and put it past Luongo.
And it was backhand.
And it was backhand.
In midair.
And it was hardly, he was not even really looking where he was going. And it's good because you know what? The pucks have not been bouncing the right way for Jonathan Toews for that first line all year long.
No.
And they got two goals and two assists out of the that first line yesterday.
Yeah, well, we got
Brandon Saad scored too.
It's just good to see them win. They're off today, then it's a back-to-back game starting tomorrow night.
Yeah,
so
the Ducks coming into town tomorrow.
Yes. And it's just good to see when they're firing on all cylinders, cuz Andy, you're right. It's been so frustrating watching some of these games where, and in fact, talking about the way the puck bounced, the way it came off Toews' stick mm-hmm. was like a knuckleball.
It was.
And Luongo had no chance on it no. at all.
And it's never a bad thing when the Blackhawks beat Roberto Luongo.
No, I actually remember going to a game. I forget who Luongo, because he's played for how many
teams now. He was
probably
with the Canucks back then, yeah.
Where he basically, the Hawks were just kicking him. I mean,
that was in the playoffs.
And he got pulled. And it was, there was nothing better than seeing Luongo getting pulled right. because all goalies, there's a certain amount of head case involved, mm-hmm. but with Roberto Luongo, that is a total head case.
Yeah, and it's fun to hear the United Center crowd on him a little bit, yeah.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. Well, we've got the Bears today, who I see are 13.5-point underdogs.
And that's probably not enough.
No, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. That's, Eagles are just, they talk about firing on all cylinders.
Mm-hmm. They're best team in football.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Now. And, you know, the Bears fans are looking towards Carson Wentz as a possible blueprint for Mitchell Trubisky. You know, the fact that Wentz struggled a little bit with no weapons around him in his first year, number two overall pick a couple of years ago, and now is, as you say, firing on all cylinders with some weaponry around him, a good running game, and Alshon Jeffrey. But the difference is, a coach with an offensive mind who actually designs a game plan that benefits his quarterback. So that's where the comparison
that's,
will
that's
stop.
A pretty good takedown yeah. right there.
Yeah. That's where the comparison will stop. Trubisky may have what it takes to do it, but until the handcuffs are taken off, we're not going to be able to see it.
Well, no disrespect, Andy, for you being here, but in a way I wish Sam was here because he kept telling me how much the Bears were going to win last week, mm-hmm. and I kept telling him, you're absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, no chance.
No chance today.
No, I don't believe so.
No. But that's our Bears, and we'll be keeping an eye on them. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Casera is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSundaySpin, all one word. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob still deciding what to do with the wishbone. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Sorry if I sound a bit impaired when I was cooking the turkey out on the grill. I somehow probably caught a cold. I don't know what, any other reason why I would come up with getting a cold except spending too much time tending to the grill. But the food turned out great. Of course, now I can't taste any of the leftovers. That's one of the problems with this post-Thanksgiving cold. But we've got a great show coming up today. After we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll be speaking to my good friend and Tribune colleague, Ted Gregory. Ted's one of the best all-around reporters and writers at the paper. And we'll talk about his new book, Mary Jane's Ghost. It's about a double homicide that happened 70 years ago in Oregon, Illinois. It's a journey back in time, a journey fast forward. It's also a journey about newspapers. So I know you'll be very interested in that. Coming up after the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to State Representative Carol Senti, a Democrat from Vernon Hills. She's authored legislation that would lower the fees for limited liability companies in an effort to spur business development and job growth. And this is also her last term in the General Assembly. We'll be talking about the atmosphere down in Springfield. After a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, we'll speak to Kent Redfield. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois. Monday is the first day of candidate petition filing for the March 20th primary, and we'll talk to him about all of the races on tap. That's all coming up, but first, it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And yes, while it was a holiday last week, there was plenty of politics going on, including the saga of the Alabama special election and Republican candidate Roy Moore's conduct nearly four decades ago involving teenage girls. On the Today Show last week, Lee Korfman talks about her experience with Moore when she was only 14 years old.
At 14, I was not dating. At 14, I was not able to make those kind of choices. I met him around the corner from my house. My mother did not know. And he took me to his home. After arriving at his home, on the second occasion that I went with him, he basically laid out some blankets on the floor of his living room and proceeded to seduce me, I guess you would say. And during the course of that, he removed my clothing. He left the room and came back in wearing his white underwear. And he touched me over my clothing, what was left of it. And he tried to get me to touch him as well. And at that point, I pulled back and said that I was not comfortable. And I got dressed and he took me home.
So that's Lee Korfman speaking about what happened to her nearly 40 years ago. Before the president took off to Florida for the Thanksgiving holiday, President Trump indicated he might actually campaign for Moore as his efforts to change the federal tax code hang in the balance between Republicans and Democrats in the United States Senate.
Well, he denies. I mean, Roy Moore denies it. And by the way, he gives a total denial. And I do have to say, 40 years is a long time. He's run 8 races, and this has never come up. So 40 years is a long time. The women are Trump voters. Most of them are Trump voters. All you can do is you have to do what you have to do. He totally denies it.
Now, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who, of course, is no fan of Donald Trump and also is not seeking re-election, Jeff Flake says the president is making a mistake by getting too close to Moore. Flake spoke on Fox News Radio.
Yeah, I think the victims are credible, and there are a number of them. And I think to a person in Congress, my colleagues have been saying the accusers are a lot more credible than Roy Moore. I think the president made a big mistake there. I think that he should distance himself from Roy Moore. even if it means losing that seat. I'm on record saying that I'd certainly rather vote for a write-in Republican. I'd rather keep that seat Republican. But if the choice is between Roy Moore and the Democrat, I would vote for the Democrat if I lived in Alabama.
Now, meanwhile, the Democrat in that Alabama U.S. Senate race, Doug Jones, is running several ads, including one that quotes Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, as well as the attorney general of the Trump administration, Jeff Sessions.
I'm Doug Jones, and I approve this message.
On Roy Moore's disturbing actions, Ivanka Trump says there's a special place in hell for people who prey on children, and I have no reason to doubt the victim's accounts. Jeff Sessions says, I have no reason to doubt these young women. And Richard Shelby says he will absolutely not vote for Roy Moore. Conservative voices, putting children and women over party, doing what's right.
That's Alabama Democrat Doug Jones's ad. In the meantime, there have been additional accusers of Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken. There's word that Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers reached a taxpayer-paid settlement with his accuser to keep quiet about allegations of sexual misconduct. And, of course, that raises the big question in Washington, why should taxpayers be paying for that? Now, before leaving Washington, President Trump sounded off again on North Korea and the ever-building nuclear threat that North Korea presents. Trump declared North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism, and that includes further sanctions.
Today, the United States is designating North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. Should have happened a long time ago. Should have happened years ago. In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. As we take this action today, our thoughts turn to Otto Warmbier, wonderful young man, and the countless others so brutally affected by the North Korean oppression. This designation will impose further sanctions and penalties on North Korea and related persons, and supports our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the murderous regime that you've all been reading about and in some cases writing about.
Now, of course, the president in Mar-a-Lago in Florida yesterday afternoon tweeting out, Fox News is much more important in the United States than CNN, but outside of the U.S., CNN International is still a major source of parentheses fake unparentheses news, and they represent our nation to the world very poorly. The outside world does not see the truth from them. So if you work at Fox News and you get that kind of endorsement, you might wonder exactly what profession you're actually in.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. There's an interesting anecdote this past week that Democratic Senator Tom Carper of Delaware shared on CNN. Carper told CNN's John Berman and Poppy Harlow about the president calling into a meeting of lawmakers over potential changes to the federal tax code. Of course, we've got all of that going on. The president calling in from Asia, and Tom Carper asked the president's chief national economic advisor, Gary Cohn, to do something. Here is that interview from CNN.
You were part of this call with the president while he was in Asia on taxes. And at one point, it's reported that you looked over to his chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, and said to him, quote, we're not going to have a real conversation here. Can you just tell the president he's brilliant and say we're losing the connection and hang up? Seriously?
Seriously, and he did. And we've been having about a half an hour conversation with Gary, with Mark Short, and with Shahira Knight, the three people from the administration. Had a great conversation. They're asking questions about 10 minimal moderate Democrats and trying to see if there's some kind of middle ground on tax reform. About 30 minutes into the call, Gary gets up and takes a call on his cell phone, comes back into the room. He says, we have somebody calling in from Asia. And it was the president, which was nice. Nice of him to do that. 15 minutes later, the president is still talking. And I said to Gary, and it was a room where we're all sitting around this big square table, and I said, Gary, why don't you do this? Why don't you just take the phone from your cell phone back and just say, Mr. President, you're brilliant. And but we're losing contact, and I think we're going to lose you now, so goodbye. And that's what he did, and he hung up. And then we went back to having the kind of conversation that we needed to, where they asked good questions, looking for consensus, looking for common ground. And I think we've identified a little bit.
Are you sorry that Gary Cohn faked a bad connection to get the president off the phone?
I'm sorry, say again?
Are you saying Gary Cohn faked a bad connection to get the president off the phone?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't want to throw him under the bus, but yes.
I think you just did.
Yeah, that's the bus. I think the bus just drove past.
The bus has passed. Yes, indeed. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend and Tribune colleague, Ted Gregory. As I said earlier, probably the best all-around reporter at the paper. That comes with the jack of all trades general assignment title.
I'm bringing donuts right after the break.
You'll pay for this, trust me. But Ted's the author of a new book, and it's called Mary Jane's Ghost, and it's really a fascinating story about a double homicide of a young couple. Down in Oregon, Illinois, which is south of Rockford on Route 2 along the Rock River. And actually, Ted, thank you for joining me this morning.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. The place looks really festive.
Indeed, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Even this early on a Sunday morning,
I know,
right?
I know.
But I worked for a couple of years at the Rockford Register Star.
All right, great.
And so I was very familiar with Oregon the River Road, Route 2.
Beautiful little stretch of roadway there.
The Black Hawk statue.
Right, love that.
That's what I call it, is the Black Hawk
statue. Right.
It's actually the Eternal Indian.
That's right.
So it was great kind of catching up on a little bit of history, but this is history that goes back 70 years.
Right.
And the book is filled, it's a fact book.
Yeah.
But some of these characters almost sound fictional. And I want you to go back to how you got this letter.
Right.
And from someone who was very interested in the June 1948 deaths of Mary Jane Reed and Stanley Skridla on a lover's lane.
Yeah, right. So as you know, Rick, we've worked at the Tribune for a long time, and I'm what they call a general assignment reporter, which means I do a little bit of everything.
The jack of all trades.
Right. And I cover local politics, and I covered Hurricane Katrina, and I've written travel stories, and I've written editorials for the Chicago Tribune.
Political stories.
That's in political stories, right? Yeah, we back in '96 was the great governor's race, right? We had a lot of fun with that one. And it's sort of a little bit of a niche that I've carved out for myself is that I'm the guy who oftentimes goes out to small towns, rural communities, and writes stories about them.
And I'm jealous because it's such an interesting beat to be able to get out of the normal kind of stuff, to be able and find these very interesting features that tell stories about parts of Illinois that people, we get so focused up here. I mean, my time spent working downstate, mm-hmm. I think, was invaluable to mm-hmm. what I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I don't mean to be rude for us folks here in Chicagoland, but, you start looking at DeKalb as no man's land kind of thing.
Right. Well, it's funny because over the years as I was doing this these stories, well outside of Chicago, I got to appreciate the state in a really different way. I got to see the state, which is my home state. I was born in Chicago and raised here. As the most American place in the United States, I really feel like it is. And if you take a look at demographic analysis of it shows up time after time after time, but also historically and culturally. Illinois was settled from the north by abolitionists that were from New York and New England, and from the south by plantation owners from Kentucky and Tennessee. So it's a really, in that role as a guy who gets out and around throughout the entire state, you really get an appreciation for it sounds weird, but how cool Illinois is. So anyway, to get back to your first question, in that role as general assignment reporter, I came to the office one day and there was a fat envelope on my desk. And in it was, among many things, was a letter that was written from Oregon, Illinois, which for folks who don't know where it is, if you get on North Avenue in Chicago and you go 100 miles west, you'll get to the Rock River, which is a very scenic place, and that's where Oregon, Illinois is. It's right on the Rock River, surrounded by 5,000 acres of state parks and forests. It's a very scenic area because it's got a lot of bluffs and rock formations. It's got a very interesting history. But the letter was written by Mike Arians, who is a slightly eccentric fellow, a former insurance fraud investigator and a dinner theater producer who moved
our owner.
Yeah, and right. He moves to Oregon in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, opens a restaurant, gets elected mayor, and then becomes obsessed with this crime that we mentioned earlier, the Mary Jane Reed Stanley Skridla crime, which is, you know, a young couple. She was 17 years old from Oregon, kind of from the wrong side of the river in Oregon, and then he was 28 years old, and he was from Rockford, and about 40 miles north of Oregon. They met at the telephone company. She was a telephone operator. He was a telephone lineman. They set up a date one night, late after she got off of work. They went to a few establishments in and around Oregon, wound up in Lover's Lane, doing what I think lovers would do on a lover's lane, young people would do on a lover's lane, and then someone approaches the car, or maybe several people approach the car, and they either pull Stanley out or Stanley confronts them. Stanley is shot several times, killed. His body is dragged to the side of the road. Mary Jane is kidnapped. That event set in motion a huge manhunt, woman hunt, I guess you'd call it. A lot of coverage, front page news, including from our own Chicago Tribune. And Mary Jane can't be found. She's not found for one day, not 2 days, not 3 days. On the fourth day, her body is found about a mile away in a roadside ditch that her father passed by on work, on his way to and from work every day. And she's partially clothed. It's unclear if she was shot, where she was shot. But anyway, this, of course, really inflames the situation. More attention, news coverage from Maine to California in the newspapers. And over time, even though they interview and interrogate a bunch of people, they don't solve it. They never solve the case, and it sort of fades from consciousness. Fast forward 50 years. Mike Arians moves to town. He becomes obsessed with it. He comes up with a very scandalous theory, which we can talk about, and he reaches out to the Chicago Tribune for help. That's the letter that lands on my desk.
And that was how long ago when you got that letter?
That was in 2003.
Okay. And when I kind of, because we get those kinds of letters all the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And sometimes you just kind of go, this is way over the deep end here.
Uh-huh.
And kind of in your initial conversations with Mike Arians,
right,
and obviously he has this great obsession.
Yes, yes, yeah.
For Mary Jane Reed.
Right, right.
That's kind of when I probably would have pulled the plug out of this thing.
See, it used to be more fun than this. But
didn't we all?
Right, right. Yeah, time has a way of wearing down, just bringing out the fun of us. You know, just like a rag. But yeah. So when I got the letter, and then it included a bunch of old newspaper clips, and I love old newspaper clippings. You know, there's really something so much fun reading them, interesting. And he included, of course, newspaper clippings all about the crime, including some from the Chicago Tribune. So I was very intrigued by the story and just the setting and, you know, thinking about this crime that occurred in 1948, still unsolved. And so, you know, the first thing that we do oftentimes when we get a letter like this is we're trying to determine if the person who's writing this letter is a nut, right? So I give him a call. And he wasn't a nut. He was very open, very candid, answered any questions I wanted, talked for as long as I wanted. You know, he was a former mayor. He had not won his reelection bid, but he was a former mayor.
He'd been in the public spotlight.
Right. He was a county board member in Kane County for a number of years. So I thought, well, what the heck, you know, this sounds pretty cool. So I went out there and of course explored a little more his belief that Mary Jane's ghost inhabits his roadhouse, and the roadhouse is, I don't know, 100 years old or so. It's a real old, kind of a rich in character place. And so when I went out there, he was just as I thought he would be on the phone. I mean, he really had this commitment to, not only to Mary Jane and, you know, the relationship he had with quote unquote her ghost, which is sort of intriguing, but I think he felt, that he was standing up for someone who hadn't been stood up for, you know, who was silent in all this, which is Mary Jane. And her family had one remaining sibling who was 6 years old at the time, her littlest brother, Warren. And Mike was very devoted to him over all these years, and I think that was part of it. And the notion that Mike's own background is kind of interesting. You know, he was kind of a kid who was dismissed and cast aside quite a bit. So there was all these factors that were sort of coming together that were really intriguing to me, and so I pursued it from there, and pursued it for 16 or 17 years.
And we'll talk about that pursuit when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Ted Gregory, my colleague at the Tribune, and author of Mary Jane's Ghost. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, speaking with my good friend Ted Gregory, author of Mary Jane's Ghost. This is a story. It's a book about a journey, and it's a journey of those 70 years since these murders occurred. But it's also a journey about newspapering.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I wanted to do with the book was make it something broader and deeper than your straight true crime narrative, because the case itself felt like it. It was more than that. And as I was following the case over all these years, and I really wasn't sure what I was going to do with it, whether I was going to write a book about it or not. But when I finally realized, sort of got my head around what kind of a book it could be, I thought it would be really interesting and fulfilling from my perspective, and kind of creatively challenging, to talk about the case, and as I followed the case, what was going on in our own existence as a newspaper at the Chicago Tribune. And so I thought that that would help illustrate kind of what it was like over those 13 years, and then what my life was like, and as a way sort of representative of the newspaper industry in general, and the state of journalism, and our need for stories, all of those themes I explore as I go about my journey as a newspaper reporter. So the main narrative is this, me following this case and sort of circling back on it, but I also weave in other stories throughout Illinois, this most American place, into the book. So you'll see stories about the restoration of the tallest, most heinous statue of
Abraham
Lincoln. Heinous Abe. You'll read about the infestation, the invasion of flying Asian carp on the Illinois River. You'll read about a siege where 22 coal miners were slaughtered in Heron, Illinois, in 1922, and then come back to the main narrative throughout the story. So that's kind of how I structured it. It turned out the way I wanted it to, and it's been a really interesting experience to have it out and about in the world.
In doing the research on this, and it was, I mean, basically, this is 13 years going back and forth to Oregon.
Yep.
Looking to justify it for the Tribune editors.
Right. Don't say that. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, because there were twists and turns.
Absolutely.
That occurred.
Oh, yeah.
There
a couple of really big ones.
Yes.
Right.
So, I mean, but as much as, you know, Mike Arians was obsessed, including a mannequin.
Oh yes,
in the Roadhouse Bar.
Right. So should I tell that story?
Well, that's where I would kind of say, okay, good luck, and I'm out of here.
So, the first trip that I went out there, after I had a phone conversation with Mike and realized that, he's a sane person, a little eccentric, but a little eccentric is always good for these kinds of stories, I think. I drove out there on a July afternoon, sweltering hot, you know, those great July afternoons here in Illinois. The Roadhouse had not opened for the day, so it was kind of closed and, dark and closed and cool. So we talked for a little bit. Mike and I talked for a little bit, and then he took me for a little tour around the place. And so we turn a corner and we get into kind of the main lounge. It's a really interesting place, the Roadhouse. I'd highly recommend people going out there just to check it out. So we turn a corner and we get into the main lounge, and he pauses and looks up and says, "She was a beautiful young woman." And I'm looking at him, and I'm not really sure what he's saying, but I cast my eyes up into the balcony, and in the balcony of this restaurant with a light on it is a mannequin dressed up as Mary Jane Reed. And at that moment...
yeah, at that moment is when I turn around and walk out of the place.
At that moment, I felt this something like a chill, you know, the proverbial chill up the spine and over my shoulders and kind of settle somewhere in my ear canal. And I thought, wow, this is going to be a pretty interesting little ride that I'm going to have today. So that's
and it was more than just today.
Oh yeah,
a long ride
over 13 years. Yeah, with all sorts of twists and turns and. Yeah, it's been really, it was a really, really interesting case for me.
And, you know, through this too, you know, allegations of cover-up.
Yes.
The fact that no autopsy was done.
Right.
A scant police file.
Yeah.
And also the issue of small-townness. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, when you mentioned earlier in the book about Mary Jane Reed coming from, like, the wrong side of the tracks, the wrong side of the river. I've been to Oregon. It's like, I didn't think it was big enough that there could be a wrong, you know.
Right.
But it's absolutely true.
Yeah, definitely. Sandtown is called.
But you get that sense of, even 70 years later, no one wanted to talk about this. No one wanted to resurrect the past.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I get it. And I'm deferential to that. People felt that leave the dead alone, that they felt that it was this bringing up this case again and again was smearing the community. My feeling is that, you know, our history is our history, and to try to explore it in an unbiased, a fair way, to try to get to the truth is a healthy thing for us, one way or the other. However it turns out, I think we become stronger, fuller people, better informed about who we are. So, as deferential as I was to those folks, it's a conservative community. I felt that it was important to at least pursue the truth.
Well, as you close the book, if I may quote, "The search for the truth, the courage to face and accept it as our own, the value in trying to gain deeper understanding, that's the noble journey." Ted Gregory? The book is a great journey, I have to tell you. Mary Jane's Ghost, University of Iowa Press.
Right.
We'll have a link to the on our website and our Facebook page.
That's great.
Ted, thank you so much.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It was really fun having the conversation. Thank you so much.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue on this sunny Sunday by Representative Carol Sente from Vernon Hills.
Morning,
Representative,
Rick.
Thank you so much for joining me here in the studio this morning.
Always nice to be here.
In the festive studio.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the folks at the Tree Time they always do a fantastic job.
It's fabulous.
And it helps put me in the, I'm sad I'm not there yet, but it's getting me there. And working in these surroundings does wonders.
Well, you have up till we hit December to get ready.
We're almost there.
Yes, we are.
We're almost there.
Yes, we are.
Well, I wanted to have you in. One thing was, we've talked on the news about this yesterday, was Small Business Saturday, which I think is actually a great idea. I know, you know, we think of American Express, which was, you know, founded, and we think of these manufactured kind of holidays, but truly, you know, as a corporation or whatever, it's such a great idea to invest in small business. You're a small business woman.
I am.
And you've had a small business advisory council in your legislative district. And, you know, we talk about citizen legislators and anymore, since the legislature mainly is nonstop anymore, that we tend to lose that kind of citizen legislator. That goes back to really what the whole idea was of having a legislature made up of individuals of varied backgrounds and varied interests that could kind of bring that kind of diversity into the game. So I know you've always kind of had been attuned, even as a Democrat, to the interests of small business.
Yeah.
And so you've got legislation, which technically hasn't been sent to the governor's desk, but it's passed the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an assist to small businesses. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I am a citizen legislator, and I've been down there through that purpose the whole time. The LLC bill was a goal of ours to reduce the fees. It is probably one of the most common ways of organizing a small business these days, and the fee is abnormally high compared to if you incorporate, even within the state, a partnership, other fees that we have, and compared to any of the states in the country, frankly, we are the highest. So it's a signal, it's a message to small business, and we needed to reduce it. So what this bill did is it reduced all the fees across the board. The two biggest ones would be when you start, which is was a $500 fee. So when this bill is signed, it will go down to $150. But then every year you file an annual report, and that was $250, and it'll go down to $75. But there are smaller fees that go along with this, and each one of them was reduced. So this has been a long process. The small business community has been watching this, and we're hoping to get it signed before the end of the year.
Why did the fees start out so high?
You know, I'm not sure why they did. I have a guess. I think that, you know, the state of Illinois is always looking for more money. And my guess is because it was the newest, most popular, someone said, let's figure out what a fee is and maybe set it a little bit higher because that'll bring in some money. What it's really doing is it's
a disincentive.
Yeah, it is.
And of course, you know, small business, sometimes it's almost like what I would term lip service about education is my number one priority. Small business is the backbone of the Illinois economy. It's the job creator. But it really is true when it comes to small business that is what helps really drive this economy. It's not the major corporations and all of that, because the bulk of the jobs are through small business.
Absolutely. You look at the statistics, small businesses are creating the jobs, they're employing people. It's the bulk of the new businesses that are being started every day. And people can choose to start in another state. Not everything is, you know, location specific. So we're losing that money.
Well, and you're from Vernon Hills, so you're not that far from the Wisconsin border.
Exactly.
And we all know about some of the migration that's occurred from Lake County across the other side.
Yeah, I hate to see that. We need to stop that.
What took so long to get this done?
So I've been working on this issue for 3 years. So have some of my other peers. Senator Cullerton passed it with me in the Senate. Representative Dave McSweeney, David Harris, they had similar bills. I think really the big pushback was we are reducing fees, and at the time when we started, we didn't have a budget. And so to say we're taking more money away from the state when we don't have that money, I think that was some of the pushback that I felt, like, why couldn't we get it all the way through? As I would present it to my peers for them to get on as a sponsor, everyone's like, on both sides of the aisle, thought, this is a great idea, you know, sign me on. You can see the list of co-sponsors is very long, yet it couldn't get all the way through both chambers and then signed. And I think that was really the reason.
Because it would seem to me, in this struggle that we've had, the ideological struggle that we've had in the budget battles, that part of it is what Governor Rauner has seen as his pro-business agenda and, mm-hmm. and the goals he wants to achieve with them against things like unions and collective bargaining and things that strike at the heart of Democrats. But then there's something like this that would seem to fall in line with the goal of, most small businesses aren't necessarily unionized,
right.
that it's, if you start a business, if you encourage business startup and development and growth, that achieves the idea of, as the governor said, you know, we have to grow our way out of this. And I think everybody would agree that that's an element of trying to fix this state.
Yeah.
But that this would be almost literally a no-brainer. And then it still takes 3 years to pass.
What can I say? Except that I think sometimes people look at, we don't have the money, we have a budget problem, so we're going to bring less money to the state.
So how much revenue was the higher fees bringing in? I mean,
I say you have to spend money to make money. It's the business adage, right? You have to send a message to small business. We want you here in Illinois. And the business climate has to change for small companies, for big companies, that they feel welcome here. That doesn't mean we have to get rid of all regulations and just have a free for all. But we have to send a message that we care about growing business here and that it's a good climate to come to Illinois.
Well, and these filings are regulations.
Yep.
But they're not regulations as much as they're fees.
Right. I mean, yes, it's just a fee on how you're organizing your business. So there's some insurance-type protections.
So, and we believe that the governor is going to sign this.
Yes. Usually when I work on bills like this, I always, you know, check how's the pulse of the current governor, because we've had two during the time I've been working on this bill. And Governor Rauner and his office and the lieutenant governor seem very anxious to get this bill passed. And so I don't anticipate, I think they're eager to sign it as well.
So we should expect to see this. And
and I'm hoping by the end of the year.
Immediate effective date?
It does.
So we'll be starting the year when these LLCs are going to be doing their annual reports and things like that.
I get some emails from people and they're like, I'm waiting. I'm about to do my renewal. Is it coming soon? And I said, I hope so.
You can't help it. They're business people, right?
Yeah, they care.
We're speaking with Representative Carol Sente, Democrat from Vernon Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is your phone number. I'm speaking to Democratic State Representative Carol Sente, who is the author of legislation expected to be signed shortly by the governor that would reduce fees for small businesses. We just had Small Business Saturday. And Representative, I ran across this cut because, you know, obviously we're talking Black Friday and we've got Cyber Monday coming up and all this kind of, let's spur the economy, it's Christmas time. I came across this cut from WNDU-TV, the NBC affiliate in South Bend, Indiana, where they had sent a reporter out to a local mall for the opening of the Black Friday stores. And, well, it didn't go so well.
Joshua Short is inside UP Mall, where the doors will be opening in just under an hour from now. Josh, how are things going?
Well, you know what, Alex? I thought I was going to be inside, and apparently I'm stuck outside because security reasons and all that other rigmarole. Look, look behind me. You see the long lines of people out here at 545 or so. We were expecting a big crowd. We don't have the big crowd that we expected. I got up at 3 o'clock excited to do my first ever Black Friday, and ain't nobody here. I am literally upset right now. I don't know why people did not wake up. They had too much food. I don't know what the deal is. You got cars coming through, but they're stuck right now in their cars. Nobody's coming out. Yeah, they open their doors at 6 o'clock, but I'm really upset right now. We don't have anybody out here. We got another news crew that I'm not going to name. She's out here. So at the moment, I'm going to send it back to y'all because ain't nobody here. I'm going back home. I'm going back to my bed, and I'm going to sleep. Alex, we send it back to you in South Bend.
Oh, Josh, I feel bad for you. David says that you're on the wrong side of the mall. So maybe that's what it is. You just got to go to the other side of the mall, and that's where the line is.
You know what? I'll go to the other side of the mall, and I'm going to see another line of cars, and nobody's going to be getting out of those cars because it's almost 30 degrees. You know what? I'm just...
Oh, Josh is gone. We lost Josh. All right. Joshua Short reporting live at the a little bit of a disappointing start to Black Friday. But don't worry, Josh. We'll come back to you, and I'm sure there will be some people there for you.
So that was the Black Friday opening at the mall in South Bend. I can't help laughing about it. Although I have to tell you, as a reporter, I can't say I'd be excited to be out trying to cover a Black Friday sale. I would actually kind of welcome the fact that nobody was there.
Exactly.
Representative, one thing I wanted to ask you about is the fact that this is your last term.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be in line tomorrow morning at the State Board of Elections at 8 a.m. to have your candidacy petitions filed. And we've seen a number of people leaving the General Assembly. And there's no doubt that, in my mind, that the budget stalemate just became a hurdle that people just are tired of it. And yeah, we do have a budget, but it's an act of the legislature, not the governor. And it's not what they signed up for. Is that, tell me about your situation.
Everyone has different reasons for leaving. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, I'm a citizen legislator, so I always thought that there would be a set period of time, and I'm in that time range, so I was thinking 8 to 12 years. In that 8 to 12 years, I'm one of the people who has been in a competitive district. In a competitive district, I've had one primary and four general elections, five elections in 8 years. It's exhausting. That alone, you're losing, you know, for 5 months of every other year, you're knocking doors and that's all you're doing. So that's hard. We don't stop campaigning anymore after the elections are over and get into legislating. So that's tough. I think there's less of an atmosphere down there for moderates. I feel like sometimes people expect me to apologize that I compromise for a bill that includes something my side doesn't want in an effort for the greater whole. That's against who I am, not to compromise, you know. And so that's kind of tough. It's been exhausting to go through and watch. Even in, it's been tough. The toughest is the last few years, and watching the polarization just increase down there. And so I thought, you know what, it's time for someone else.
Well, and it doesn't show any signs of abating, and the fact of how money has become such a principal driver in these campaigns, and you're in a district that is a competitive district, and the fact that there's pressures, I'm sure, on both sides, that some would say, well, you're not liberal enough.
Oh, yes.
And then, of course, the Republicans calling you a liberal. And when you mentioned about compromise, it comes to mind the idea of the school funding formula legislation as a prime example of that. Because of to make it happen, also included the private school scholarship tax exemption. And, you know, we're hearing from even Democratic governor candidates that as soon as they get in, that's wiped out. They're going to eliminate it. And it just, you know, whatever I personally might feel about it, the bottom line is, you know, that's how you get that's how laws become laws. You don't get the whole loaf. And it's the desire to get the whole loaf and that desire for purity and that doesn't necessarily create good legislation or doesn't even get to legislation. It never gets that far.
I think that's what we're missing. That's what's dropping out. And with that education funding bill, how I explained it, because people are like, well, what do you think about it? Why did you sell out? Why did you compromise? I said I had a bigger problem that there wasn't a funding source for that. For that piece that the governor added in at the last moment. And while I don't particularly like the tax credit for the private school voucher, whatever you want to label it, again, it's a compromise. And what we did with the education funding reform piece is revolutionary. And being at the bottom in the country and how much we fund education, I was thrilled to have that piece in. People lose sight of the fact that with this budget, there was compromise. There's a lot of things that you could say it wasn't perfect. It didn't. It was a little short. It was this. It was that. But the budget and the reforms that we accomplished this year, and I know earlier in the year I was here with Steve Anderson, we talked about our group. When people lose focus on is it's under our budget was under the amount that the governor set it for the revenue ceiling in his budget address. It was under the tax increase amount that he had also suggested he wanted. It includes significant cuts. And this year we got four of the reforms that he wanted as part of the budget accomplished. Some pretty significant reforms. In addition, during the spring session, we got two extra ones not tied to the budget done. So six in total. And we never focus on that. We always focus on what didn't happen and the partisanship. But a lot did get done.
And you know, as you mentioned, you were here with Steve Anderson, who at that time was the House Republican floor leader, and even on that show said, primary, bring it on. Mm-hmm. Lost his floor leader title.
Yep.
And now he's not seeking re-election either. And again, it's that middle that, frankly, that's where most Illinoisans are, and it's the middle is no longer really being represented.
And most Illinoisans say that they're in the middle, and I hope we still have that, but we're not hearing from them. Legislators aren't hearing from them.
But you never hear from them, though.
Yeah. Maybe we didn't.
I tend to think, though, you never hear from the middle. It's always the extreme.
The fringes, yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is on both sides. You know, that's the squeaky wheels. And they get the noise, and it's the middle has to deal with whatever comes out of the government that produces.
Well, I hope with all the legislators that are leaving that we can do some good work in our final year, because we're going to struggle getting a budget this coming session as well.
Do you think there's going to be a budget?
I hope so. That's why I am going to stay down there and make sure that to everything in my ability that we can get a budget, because that will be very important. And going into an election year, I think we're going to see it's going to be difficult, very challenging.
I have to say I appreciate your optimism, even as you depart the scene. I'm not as optimistic. I just have to think with the political stakes that are at hand that once again it's going to be the politics that overshadows the substantive actions in this.
I don't disagree with you, but I feel like we've seen a path to move through that, and it wasn't the traditional path, as Steve and I were talking about when we were down here and all the others that were engaged with us, is us working together behind the scenes and saying, we can't let this happen. And those people are all still there.
Well, and we'll see if a bottom-up driven initiative can occur.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Carol Sente, Democratic State Representative from Vernon Hills, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Always nice to see you. Happy holidays.
And to you.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, the Christmas decorated tree time showcase studio. here in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. A little brisk morning out there, but we're supposed to get up to around 50 degrees. And actually, the temperatures this week, very temperate for this end of November as we start rolling into full-scale Christmas holiday time. Well, joining me now on the phone is Kent Redfield. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And tomorrow is a holiday of its own when everybody gets up and gets in line so that they can be have a chance to have their name as first on the ballot in the March primary. They'll all be in line outside the State Board of Elections in Springfield. And joining us from Springfield is Kent Redfield. Kent, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So first things first is I think everybody looking for someone to file, and it's a week-long filing period. It ends the following Monday. But everybody's looking to see whether three-term state representative Jeannie Ives files for the Republican primary for governor and what kind of challenge she presents to Republican Governor Bruce Rauner.
Oh, I think that's the major, that will be the major event. You may get, surprise candidates filing for some of the constitutional officers on the Republican side. They're, still looking for, opponents for some longtime Democratic incumbents but the real action is whether we know we're going to have a very active Democratic primary on the gubernatorial side. And the question is whether Bruce Rauner is going to get a challenge and whether it's going to be a credible challenge.
What would make it a credible challenge for Jeannie Ives to take on Bruce Rauner?
She needs to get enough visibility, so that her message gets out, and then she has to put together a message that makes her appealing to the Republican electorate in terms of the primary. And I think that's probably a combination of ideology in terms of being the true conservative and the true Trump supporter in the primary. And then positioning, saying that she is the person that, can carry the mantle and be competent, and that, the governor says nice things, but, he's really been a failure in terms of, taxes going up, the state's in debt, we've got he's signing legislation that's pro-immigration, that's not pro-life, and so that's, she has to have a message and she has to have enough money. It's easier to imagine the message than in terms of the money, because the governor is sitting there with, at least $65 million in the bank and has been spending, over the last, things are kind of quiet now over the holidays, but he had a big advertising blitz going on, in the first part of the month.
Well, and for her candidacy, she seems to want to focus on the economic type issues, although certainly she represents the social conservative issues. She says her candidacy was motivated by the governor's signature on the legislation that expanded taxpayer subsidized abortion. She has been against same-sex marriages, gay rights, those kinds of issues, but seems to want to focus more on economic issues. Is that a longer-term strategy, or is that the fact that everybody in that core Republican base knows where she stands on the social conservatism?
I think it's probably both. Obviously, if she were to get to a general election, and that is certainly a long shot, then she has to attract more than the Republican base, because in the presidential election in 2016, Hillary Clinton got 56% of the vote, and Donald Trump got 39% of the vote, about 5% other. And so, you have to if you're going to win in Illinois, as Bruce Drowner did in 2014, you know, you've got to attract moderate voters in the suburbs while holding on to a Republican base. But so there is a long term to that. But in terms of, you know, the Republican primary, about 50% of that is going to, the vote's going to come from downstate, and then about 30% in the collar counties, and maybe 20% from Cook County. And the collar and the Cook County votes, you know, maybe down from what they were four years ago, because there's a hot Democratic primary, and so you're going to get people that are not regular party voters, maybe pulling Democratic ballots rather than Republican ballots compared to 4 years ago. So she's got to, you know, run in the electorate that's going to be there in March, but then whoever wins has to run in the electorate that's going to show up in November.
And we don't really know what that March Republican electorate necessarily is going to be. I mean, Bruce Rauner 4 years ago was kind of an unknown quantity, never ran for public office before in that Republican primary. Still had the financial resources, but kind of presented himself almost as a blank slate. And now we have the experience of his time in office. And is there an enthusiasm gap, perhaps, that might exist as he seeks reelection?
Well, that really has to be the concern. You know, he has to be concerned that you're going to have conservative voters enthusiastically voting against him in the primary, because they're upset with the fact that he has not been good on their issues in terms of the social issues. And then, in spite of the promises, you know, that I'm going to come in and fix things and turn things around and deal with the Democrats, you know, we now have a tax increase. The state has, you know, pick a number, $15 billion worth of unpaid bills, although they have that number has probably gone down. And, you know, and Mike Madigan is still Speaker of the House. And so, that's going to be the problem in the primary, is, that he hasn't delivered on some things. And in fact, he certainly, you know, the Ives's campaign would be a backlash against both not delivering on his issues and that he said he would deliver on, and then you know, essentially hurting the conservatives in terms of their issues, where the kind of the promise was, you know, I don't have an agenda, I don't have a social agenda. The promise was that nothing was going to happen there anyway, but he could deliver in terms of turning the state around economically. And all he has at this point going to the voters is, you know, trust me, this time I'll get it right. And that may not be the best message.
And again, for Ives, it's a matter of trying to become more than just a protest vote.
Yes, yes. And we see her. You know, there was an item last week in the last 10 days with a kind of a Make America Great Again Trump rally in Rockford, and Ives was there and presenting herself as, you know, a Trump supporter, that I voted for Trump, that, you know, he's good on immigration, he's good on judges, and so you're going to see, I think, her trying to appeal to Trump voters, and Trump, in terms of presidential election in downstate Illinois, he ran about, you know, ran at about 60% of the vote, and Clinton at about 35% of the vote, almost an exact turnaround of what the vote was statewide. And so she's certainly going to be looking for Trump voters downstate and trying to make those linkages. Again, if she has, you know, the money to be able to get out there. She's going to get media attention because she's running against the governor, and part of the governor's base is upset with him, and that's a good story, but she has to have the money to put together an organization and get the message out there, and that remains to be seen.
We're speaking with Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pierce from the Chicago Tribune, joined on the phone by Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. We're talking about tomorrow being the first day of the week-long candidate petition filing period down at the State Board of Elections in Springfield, and kind of some of the things to look toward. Not only is it the start of that period for the state primary ballot, but also locally begins the filing period for local offices. And of course, one that we'll be looking at is here in Cook County for Cook County Board President. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning to you, Rick. And Professor, yes, that's what I wanted to ask you about, the Cook County Board President's race. Will some of that rejection of County Board President, will some candidate, particularly I'm hearing that Theoretti has been able to get a lot of signatures, so maybe you can just comment on it. Also, I'm hearing that there is a pack out there that will be back in some of these county board races, but particularly will he be able to maybe take advantage of some of that rejection that was earlier from the tax repeal with Cook County Board President Craig Wickham. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thank you, Ron. Bob Fioretti says that he's going to file a challenge to Tony Preckwinkle, and given the furor over the soon-to-be-abolished sweetened beverage tax, I think that takes effect on December 1st, but given that, there's a great deal of belief that she's very politically vulnerable.
Oh, I think that in retrospect, the soda tax certainly was a mistake. I may not have been an economic mistake in terms of the county obviously needs revenue. And we're going through, there certainly have been some pretty serious budget cuts proposed, but that kind of tax is something that is very, very visible, and anything time that people kind of feel like they're getting it in the pocketbook, and that it really is the average person that's bearing the brunt, that certainly creates an opportunity. So I think that she's likely to get a challenger. It's a question of money and an organization, and she certainly will start with those two advantages. But I think there's no question that she's in a much worse political position than she was 6 months ago.
And of course, there's talk of Todd Stroger running again, which this is kind of interesting. You look at Todd Stroger, you look at former Governor Pat Quinn running for attorney general nomination. How should voters treat that?
Well, their name familiarity is there. But one, that also comes with a record. And so, there were probably good reasons why, Todd Stroger is no longer the county board chairman. Similarly, there were good reasons why Pat Quinn is no longer governor. And so, even though there might be some buyer's remorse in terms of, Governor Rauner for some Democratic voters, there gets a point at which candidates kind of become perennial candidates, and you can't afford to lose too many races before people really do want a fresh face. But there's no question that having name familiarity gets you over the hump. I mean, that's Lots of people really have no idea who Jeannie Ives is at this point. We're talking about the governor's race, and so if you bring a name or a very fat wallet, you can overcome being unknown. But it's always that first hurdle. You've got to become visible before you can become viable.
Well, when I look at, for example, the Democratic statewide ticket, and, you know, with the vast number of people running for attorney general, but also running for governor, and if the Democrats end up, you know, on March 21st with a ticket with Pat Quinn as the Democratic nominee for attorney general, doesn't that kind of change the whole dynamic of the entire statewide contest?
Well, it is going to, I think whoever is the Democratic nominee for governor, is going to want to be forward looking in terms of this is how, these are the sins of the Rauner administration and this is the new era. And, the governor will be sitting there, assuming that he wins the Republican nomination. If Pat Quinn is on the ballot, then, he'll be talking about the same old gang. Here, Pat Quinn's back and, Mac Madigan is still running the legislature, and one of his particularly if it's Pritzker, this is Madigan and the unions guy, and this is the same old crowd, and we need to go out and shake up Springfield and turn things around. And so it probably would help the governor's message to have Pat Quinn on the ballot if it turns out that way.
Yeah, because it would seem to me that he can just replay basically a campaign against Quinn from 4 years ago, inserting the new name of whoever the Democratic governor nominee is, but basically making the same arguments about, look at what happened the last time Quinn was governor.
Yeah, they're back, and they want to be completely in control, and we might even be talking about, we'll substitute Pat Quinn for Lisa Madigan, and the speaker's still running all of state government, and so that plays back into the theme. I guess the other thing that will be interesting in terms of Ives is there's a possibility of, we haven't had a lot of dark money in Illinois, money that comes in where you really don't know where the sources are. We saw a little bit of that in the Democratic primary, last time around, but there certainly is some talk about fundraising by Dan Prof with the Liberty Principles PAC and people associated with the Illinois Policy Institute, John Tillman, and then there's an Illinois Opportunity Project that's Prof and a guy named Blazer, and they're talking about $25-30 million worth of dark money. So they're certainly, this would be like, on the Republican side is kind of the Koch brothers kind of money. And so, whether that would show up, in terms of funding the Ives campaign, we don't know at this point, but there certainly is a possibility that there's some money out there. It probably is going to be focusing on legislative races rather than the governor's race, but there is a possibility of some sources of money that would allow her to compete.
All kinds of things that we'll be watching starting tomorrow as candidates begin to file their candidacy petitions for the March 20th primary. Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. As always, Kent, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, certainly.